A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP of Data Mesh Consulting Services at Starburst and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading sponsor for Trino, the open source project, and Jamak's Data Mesh book, delivering data-driven value at scale. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Paul Andrew, technical architect at Avanade and Microsoft Data Platform MVP. Paul started by sharing his views of the chicken and egg problem of how much do you build out your data platform and when to support your data product creation and ongoing operations. Is that once you've built a few different data products out and then you start to build out your platform? Do you build it before? How complex do you build out your platform depending on where you are in your data mesh data product journey? And how that discussion becomes even more complicated in a brownfield deployment that already has existing requirements, expectations, and some templates. For Paul, delivering a single data mesh data product on its own is not all that valuable. If you're going to go to the expense of implementing data mesh, you need to be able to satisfy use cases that cross domains. And the greater value is in cross-domain interoperability, getting to a data product that really wasn't possible before because you're combining data across multiple domains. And you need to deliver the data platform alongside those first two to three data products. Otherwise, you create a very hard to support data asset, not really a data product in Paul's view. When thinking about minimum viable data mesh, Paul views an approach leveraging DevOps and generally CI/CD or continuous integration, continuous delivery as very crucial. You need that repeatability slash reproducibility to really call something a data product. We've learned that from the software side of the world as well. In a brownfield deployment, Paul sees leveraging existing templates for security, infrastructure as code, and all of that as the best path forward. Supplement what you've already built to make it usable for your new approach with data mesh. You've already built out your security and compliance model. Make it into that infrastructure as code to really reduce the friction for new data products and make it so that it's easy for scalability. For Paul, being disciplined early in your data mesh journey is key. A proof of concept for data mesh is often only focused on really the data set or the table or the view itself, not actually generating a data product, and much less a minimum viable data mesh. It's pretty easy to put yourself in a very bad spot by going down that proof of concept of only going for a data set or a table, because taking that from proof of concept to actual production, it's going to be a very hard transition. And telling users it will take weeks to months to productionalize, it's probably not going to go well. You've already created the data. What do you mean it's going to take that long to really make this into an actual viable data product? So be disciplined to go far enough to test out a minimum viable data mesh instead of just doing a simple proof of concept. Paul emphasized the need for pragmatism in most aspects when implementing a data mesh. Really think about when to take on tech debt and do so with intention. When shouldn't we take on tech debt? And we really should focus on technical purity. And how do we pay down tech debt and when? There's always going to be that balance between getting it done now and kind of getting it with kind of getting it done dirty and that technical purity aspect. How do we choose what features to sacrifice? What is the time value to money aspect, or how much importance do we have on getting it done sooner rather than more completely? These are questions you'll ask repeatedly in a data mesh implementation. Similar to what previous guests mentioned, Paul is working to encourage the data product marketing and discovery process. Discussing with data consumers what they want, you know, kind of that pie in the sky thinking, what would you want if you could get everything you wanted? Then taking kind of what people are looking for and speaking with the data producers and figuring out, you know, kind of what's pragmatic there, what's a pragmatic approach, and what aspect of this data product might be super difficult. If that one aspect is going to be super difficult, do you go to the consumers and you let them know that that part of it will delay significantly their delivery and that they also need to fund that part of it? Do they still want that specific aspect? Use that back and forth discussion to drive negotiations to a valuable solution with less effort on everybody's part. Look for that return on investment, not just return. You know, wouldn't it be great if we had these 20 different pieces of this data product? Well, number 20 of those 20 pieces is 80% of the work. Do you really need that? Be pragmatic. Paul recommends making business value your general data mesh North Star. Ask the pragmatic questions. So shift the data function from taking requests or requirements to negotiation. Have the conversation of, is this worth it? Who is going to pay for it? What is it worth to them? As of now, Paul and his team, when they're in a consulting engagement, are still often functioning as that kind of translator between data producers and data consumers. But when discussing that goal of getting out of being that middleman slash translator type of role, Paul pointed to a few signs that an organization is ready for producers and consumers to directly work with each other. Some aspects are, you know, kind of what's the general company culture? Is it one that is super, super siloed or not? How data literate and capable are the execs so that they can really understand what they're really trying to drive towards, and data platform maturity and a few other aspects. If you can mature your organization's approach and skill level, you can move towards not needing to have that data translator. Paul talked about how to think about your data mesh journey and different elements of it, even a data product, in that kind of crawl, walk, run fashion. Think about your data products first and foremost as serving at least one specific purpose, answering kind of one specific question. Still create those data products with reuse in mind, but they should have a use case to serve, and you can expand it from there. At a mesh level, crawling might be getting to a few standard interfaces for data products to use to communicate. You know, that's not going to be the full mesh level, but that's important to get there from a crawl standpoint. And then when you think about walking, it might be having more interfaces and that there's easy to use reusable blocks that you can just drop into your data product. At the data platform level, a crawl aspect might be getting to a place where it is possible to publish new data sets, but walking might be a significant reduction in friction to that producing those new data products. While this all means that a minimum viable mesh is still a pretty high bar, you can get to a place that is comfortable with being at that crawling stage and understanding that you're going to get to the walk and that you're going to get to the run. And it gives you a more simple target for where you want to get to first, and that you can really figure out what you really, really need. We've talked about this in previous episodes too, figuring out what you really need rather than trying to build it ahead of time when you don't know your real needs, and kind of thinking of it in that data field of dreams of, you know, if we build it, they will come. And if we build it, it will create value. And it's like, you really need to have those conversations first and figure out what you're really trying to accomplish. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into the episode.
With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview.
Very excited about today's episode here. I've got Paul Andrew, who's a technical architect at Avanade, and he's also a Microsoft Data Platform MVP. And I had asked Paul on, I started the conversation because he's put out a series of posts about kind of how you would actually create a data mesh architecture aspect on Azure. And, you know, some of the stuff is some of the plumbing side, you know, being a data platform MVP, but some of it's also, you know, the pattern side and things like that. So I wanted to kind of get his view of things, of how we really think about how the platform fits in. And so we're going to kind of cover a bunch of different things about greenfield versus brownfield, all the different stuff he's learned from working with, you know, clients that are working towards data mesh, looking at it, or actually implementing data mesh. And we're going to kind of start off in that concept of, should we think about building out the data platform first or the data products first? Or how do we think about that data platform really supporting creation of those data products? Because, you know, it's all got to kind of tie together, but it's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. So I think it's an important aspect to really think about where we jump into and when. And, you know, a lot of people are thinking you have to fully build out your platform first and all that. So, with that, Paul, if you don't mind giving a bit of an introduction to yourself, we can kind of jump into the topic at hand.
Yeah, sure. Hi, everybody. And thanks, Scott, for having me on the show. So, I mean, I guess the fortunate thing for your viewers is that this is audio only, so they don't get to see just how gray my hair is and how gray my hair's got over the last few years working as a, you know, as a data professional in this industry. I think, depending on how far you want to go with my background, I mean, I started life actually as a, you know, first line support on the service desk, you know, resetting people's passwords and installing printers and doing all that good stuff. So, yeah, my background really is, I guess I could say, from the trenches and then very much leading up to the present day. I got my data bug probably 20 or so years ago now, actually creating pivot charts, pivot tables from my phone bill to find out when I text and call people the most. You know, just a bit of fun. But then obviously applied that love of data to my day job as sort of a data management BI developer type person way back when. And then, you know, as we moved from on-premises to more cloud type technology, made that shift and been then working as a consultant supporting customers in all sorts of industry verticals since then. So that's I guess a bit about me. To bring it then to your point about the platform versus the data product, I think the thing that we just need to be honest and admit to ourselves is that it's hard. It's hard to figure out what should come first, and yet it is a chicken or an egg, and I think it really does nicely feed into that brownfield versus greenfield type setup that you have, and particularly as well for those customers that still have a very large on-premises estate and they're looking to migrate to the cloud as well. And I think the way I try and sum up all of those parts is, if we think about, you know, if we want to drive for that data mesh architecture, we can say to ourselves, well, okay, what does a minimum viable data mesh look like? Yeah, we talk about a minimum viable product all the time, but what does a minimum viable mesh look like? And I think to that, you know, we want all of the good stuff in there. We want that platform to be established, and we want to bring those data products in as well. But yeah, what can we do to achieve that? It feels like maybe we need a parallel approach to it, you know, a two-pronged attack or a three-pronged attack to delivering the platform while we're looking at establishing our data products. Or, you know, at the very least, do we need to deliver one or two data products in that mesh to begin with before, you know, we really see any value of it. Of course, that scalability that we want to achieve with many data products, if they're going to benefit from each other in this mesh ecosystem, then, you know, one data product on its own, I would say, isn't viable. So it does, as a consultant, you know, I end up saying it depends a lot to my customers. and yeah, sadly, I think it is one of those, it depends. But yeah, a two or three pronged attack is perhaps what you require to deliver the platform and maybe to try and deliver two data products. So, you know, that three pronged attack, does that give you then that minimum viable data mesh possibly?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing I see is a lot of people talking about, you know, data mesh for the sake of data mesh. And I think keeping that eye on what are we actually trying to accomplish here? And so, you know, when you first start out your journey, you're trying to drive towards value and kind of build that muscle and your understanding. So thinking about that minimum viable, and, you know, Henrik Gothberg on his episode talked about, really thinking about what do we need to build out that is repeatable and not getting ourselves into tech debt, right? And this, I think, is the thing with the data platform, is you can get yourself into a lot of tech debt versus, we can continue to do things manual and we can think of our data products as V0.1, not 1.0. And I think that's useful on the platform side. So you've been working with customers, and, you know, it really does depend, I think, is the thing that I hear from every single consultant. And I think that's the thing that frustrates people, but it's also like, if you actually want to do this right, it depends is the correct answer. Like, think about how this applies to your situation. But so when we think about building out that initial platform to support those first couple of data products, what are you seeing as kind of the most important aspects to get there? You know, because there's the kind of CI/CD data ops type of approach. There's the infrastructure as code. Does everything have to be managed as code, or can you kind of be hand managing some pipelines? You know, what have you found is the kind of secret sauce for what you really need to do to get to minimum viable, right? From both minimum and viable.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I've obviously got that Microsoft bias, so I'll probably talk about some Microsoft technologies, but yeah, whatever we want to think about. I think the CI/CD part, or the, you know, the DevOps part is really crucial, not just for delivering a data mesh solution, but for delivering any, you know, data product, software, whatever. You know, we need discipline there. We need good practice. So what I see is we will start with that infrastructure as code, and, you know, we'll supplement it with some people and process, and we'll get that security model sort of up and running as well. And I think what happens, or what tends to happen, is that the common resources that my customers want to deploy, if it's a data factory or Databricks or a data lake, they will have their own internal repository and, you know, template libraries, either an ARM template or Terraform, or, you know, whatever that may be. So they'll probably have that already, and they might start with that, and they might reuse those templates to give them that infrastructure as a code. But then when we start thinking about that in the context of what is going to be a data product that then uses it, they will say, fine, you know, let's take those templates, let's think about the interfaces that we want, or the endpoints that are going to exist for those data products. And they will, you know, they'll supplement those templates with other bits of code and things to get to, you know, a set of libraries almost, or a marketplace of things that the internal customers can then use to actually deploy what they need for whatever they're going to do. And as you know, I'm sure we're aware, you know, when we go to the Azure portal, for example, and we say, yes, give me Databricks, you can, you know, just do leave all the defaults and next and deploy. But of course, for a lot of enterprise customers, those defaults options, the default configuration, it's not good enough for them. They need more. They want additional security or additional customizations and things like that. So we've got to start, I think, yes, with that infrastructure as a code to make sure that the resources we deploy are compliant for that customer's environment. I think, yeah, that's just a good starting point for any solution, that you'll probably end up with that. There's the security model that then comes in, and then there's that process around, okay, what does your continuous integration look like? What does your continuous delivery look like? How many environments are you going to have for this thing? You know, the lot of customers I see, the four seems to be about the right number at the moment, you know, dev, tests, pre-production and production. So I think once we've got that ability to deploy what we need and that ability to get it through those gateways in terms of the environments and getting something into production, I think that's a lot of stuff that we've done up front that really sort of helps us on our way in delivering what we need.
Yeah, and one that's really helpful, I think, because one thing I've been talking about with governance is, I think in your initial data products, you don't think as much about how, you know, especially if you've got two data products that you're looking at, you can kind of have that manual interoperability. You don't have to have the governance all worked out, but you have to do kind of CYA governance of, you know, cover your butt kind of governance. And then you can figure out the rest of the stuff. So I think that security model is really important. And a couple of people have talked about, you know, this data product would be more valuable if we had PII in it or sensitive information. But to start, we don't have great templates for our PII masking and, you know, all that. So we just left the PII out. Yes, it would be more valuable. Yes, we want to include it. Yes, we actually have that data in the data product landing zone, so that when we have our template, we already have the data there. It's ready to be added to it, but it's just not accessible right now. So I think that's really interesting. And I haven't heard many people talk about that CI/CD being so crucial. Is that from like a repeatability, scalability, or trustability, or is it ease, or like what? Why is that CI/CD so? You know, a couple of people have said, you know, you can do a lot of this stuff very, very manually to start, but you're saying that you'd kind of err much more on the not letting it be so manual. What, like, help me understand your point of view on that. I'm not saying one's right or wrong. You know, I think if you can get to CI/CD, you do want to do that as early as possible. But like, what is it that you think adding that in the early phases is the most useful?
I think it's just about discipline and getting into that mindset, because, you know, I've seen people do pilots and proof of concepts, and yes, it's very, you know, very quick. It's very easy to iterate because it's a single environment proof of concept that you're working with. You know, and that's fine. And I've seen proof of concepts, you know, we prove the concept. It's great. It works. We want to move forward with what we're then doing. And somebody says, fine, can you take everything that you delivered for the proof of concept and now, you know, look at deploying it again and giving me the next version of it that we could take as our version 0.1 or whatever? And the answer comes back of, well, no, because when we created that proof of concept, we were just figuring it out. We were, you know, very quick and manual and using interfaces and whatever and failing fast, which yeah, is fine. But it means then that suddenly we've proved the concept, you know, tick. But then actually when we start to build something real, we then end up with a massive lead time between the proof of concept being, you know, successful and starting with that actual environment. And I've had program managers, project managers, whoever come to me and say, well, why does it take us so long to get from a proof of concept to actually delivering the environment? And the answer I've seen is, well, because we didn't have those CI/CD type practices instilled within what we were doing from the beginning. So yeah, you end up with that sort of massive lead time between going from a POC to something real, as one example of why it could be quite important.
That's interesting. I talked to somebody else who's going to be on in the next few episodes, who kind of had that same view about proof of concept. And I guess when I'm thinking of proof of concept, it's proof of concept of a data mesh is so much different than proof of concept of a data product, right? Is that how you think about it too? Because that proof of concept needs to have that viability. You need to figure out, can we build this muscle to actually do this? Not, can we do a proof of concept to say, can we create, you know, valuable analytical data? If you can't do that, then you're just, you know, you're not nowhere near ready for this. But do you think of that proof of concept or that proof of value or viability needs to include that aspect as well of the CI/CD approach and the, or what would we automate, or that you start with a much lower kind of target that is easy to actually get to repeatability for your proof of concept, that you don't go for something quite as complicated to put together, that it's something that is only refreshed on a daily basis, and that it's not the most complicated of logic, and that you could manage it relatively manually until you get there?
I think short answer then yeah, absolutely. But to your point, I've seen technology comes along and we use it, we play around with it, and it solves the problem, and we think, yeah, great. But then, you know, suddenly, because that piece of technology maybe in a Microsoft world is so new, that actually the configuration or the parts that we need to deploy it aren't supported in Terraform yet. You know, Terraform's a third party, they don't cover everything. Maybe there's a lead time. So yeah, something like that could have seen happen where yes, we've got a proof of concept, we've got the tech, we want to use it. Oh, actually there isn't a Terraform template for it yet, or there's some part of Terraform that doesn't support it. Yeah, because there's just a lead time in Terraform doing what they need to do to bring their own libraries up to date, yeah, which is perfectly fair. So I think, yeah, back to the point of, it's absolutely, if we're considering CI/CD, we're considering that good practice, then it's something that really should be thought about from the beginning to make sure you've covered all those options and, you know, you don't find any surprises.
Yeah, and I think... Or that you set those expectations, right? It's like, this is the big issue that I have when people talk about stuff with the data lake and things like that, is you might find this really, really valuable data resource, but you don't know if it's being updated. And so you don't know the process that it took to get updated, and can it be repeatable? You know, I had this being on the business operations side, you know, I'll go through a very, very complicated thought process to take raw data and do, it's not, you know, five transforms. It will be 400, 500 transforms as I'm trying to, you know, beat the data into submission to tell me different facts. And so I might have, you know, fact one, or, you know, what the data tells me for number one, and then number two, and number three, and number four, and number five, but I can't get the data back into the shape to tell me number one again very easily. And so then it's like, okay, let's go through all these different steps. And so do you think about when we get to that proof of concept again, what I'm seeing is people jumping to trying to do complicated data sets and things like that, versus what I've kind of been telling people is, fine, look for the ROI instead of the return when you're thinking about your proof of concept of, we want to go for low investment, high ROI, right? Where it might not be the most valuable thing you could do, but it's a quick win and it's relatively low investment and it's relatively low difficulty. Are you finding that, one, that people are willing to do that, or do they want to go for those home runs instead of let's hit, you know, well, I guess you're in the UK, so maybe go for the single instead of the four or the six bagger on cricket or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not going to try and use any sports analogies there. I'll probably embarrass myself even more than you. But I think definitely, of course, yeah, we're all trying to get that value, that insight from that data, and we're all trying to do it as quickly as possible using whatever tools we've got available. So yeah, it's an interesting problem. Yeah, do we? And I think the key word here just has to be pragmatism. We have to be pragmatic with. What do we do? Yeah, do we really go for what I call technical purity? I use it the word to my customers a lot. That technical purity of you know, we do everything in the most disciplined, you know, most due diligent way, and we get all of the libraries and all of the boilerplate code, and it's brilliant. But of course, that means a massive upfront investment. So we have to be pragmatic. What do we sacrifice with our delivery process that means that the person that, yeah, wants that return on the investment gets it sooner? And I think that pragmatism, it has to come from all directions. The delivery process, we have to be pragmatic on what we sacrifice, the cost of the platform. Maybe, you know, if we venture into the reliability of it, you know, thinking about some of the non-functional requirements of disaster recovery, failover, things like that. You know, do we have to bake all of that stuff in from day one? And if the answer is yes, then of course that means we have to do a whole load of upfront engineering, which means that, yeah, that return on the investment just gets kicked down the road another 6 months or something. And people don't want to hear that. So, yeah, pragmatism is maybe the takeaway there.
Well, and how do you think about having that conversation? I mean, you know, I think negotiation instead of requirements is the number one thing that I'm hearing from a lot of folks. But, like, how do you think about having that conversation, especially around this is, like, we need to be pragmatic around that, but this is technical debt. Take intention that you are bringing on, you are creating technical debt with this. And are we creating a solution that we can't migrate away from versus are we creating something that is okay for right now, but that we can migrate away from, right? That it's tape. It's not that we're hot gluing it together when it needs to be welded, but then we can't actually weld it together because we've got the hot glue in there and it's just going to create more of a mess trying to weld it versus we're taping it and we understand that it's just taped together at this point.
Yeah, technical debt is definitely a subject that gets a lot of attention, doesn't it? It can generate a lot of argument. I did write a blog recently just to try and define technical debt to support some delivery work that I was doing. And one of the things I tried to define there was around just compliance of the platform and the resources. Because if we deliver something now and we find later it's not compliant, then we incur all that tech debt and maybe we have to revisit or... I talked about the strategic approach versus the tactical approach that we have to take. You know, where in our technical roadmap do we make a key design decision that says, yes, you know, we want this, we want some technical purity, but actually in reality, we can't do that now. We take the tactical approach, we deliver some value, and then we get chance to iterate and gain that momentum. And we get to then revisit that technical debt and we then get to take the strategic technical purity route because, yeah, we can. I think you've got to deliver something to have the ability to fail fast and iterate. If you try and front load too much, then you end up taking too long to deliver anything, and then you never get a chance to recover. You might have the best platform in the world, but you know, if you've got no output from it, you've got no value from it, then you know, is that great platform really worth anything?
Yeah, the folks Göran and Alden at NAV in their episode, kind of, Göran is, you know, a data person, and he talked about if I'm creating something, I can create the most cool, amazing platform of all time, but the developers won't want to use it, right? Like, there's yeah. that aspect too of we think that this is going to be the thing that people are really, really going to want to use, and then you find out that that's not necessarily the case. And so, I mean, it's I know it all depends and things like that, but when you're having those conversations with people and you're asking them to make the choices, you know, again, negotiation doesn't have to be combative. Negotiation can be cooperative negotiation of like, hey, like, we need to think about these offsets. We need to say, okay, if you want this, it is going to take 6 months if we want to do this. It's fine, we'll do that, but like, let's figure out how we get there. But like, how are you finding that conversation around data? What I've found with data folks is that historically, especially with the data warehouse, you were trying to thread the needle, right? You were doing all this pre-work and it was locked in, and that you didn't think about iteration. Because it was that you tried to lock as much value as you could up front and then just kind of hold on for dear life as things started to crumble around it, right? As things started to change, and you're just like, okay, but we want to just keep trying to maintain exactly what we've got, because that iteration pain is so huge. So like, are you finding that people are willing to have those iteration conversations? Is it that the developer side are very, very open to it and the consumer side are not as open to it? Like, how are you finding those conversations? And then let's wrap in kind of what you were talking about, brownfield versus greenfield, where, you know, it's even more complex of trying to, I almost think that the greenfield is a little bit more complex, because the brownfield, it's like, we've got this stuff. Like, there are realities. You have to face realities versus greenfield. So just talked at you a lot there, but would love to kind of hear what your experience has been and what your thoughts are and what your advice might be to people that are going through similar.
Yeah, I think sure that, you know, there's a few ways we can go at it. And maybe what can give you the most value and the most reward is maybe reverse engineer it, you know, come at it from the outputs. And when I say the outputs, I mean, yeah, let's think about the consumers of that data. Let's, you know, define the personas of who is going to consume our data product. You know, a data scientist, a CEO, you know, everything in between, whatever. But, you know, let's go and seek out those people, you know, maybe a handful of those people to begin with. Ask them what it is that they want from this solution. Don't ask them what they require. Just ask them what they want. You know, just give them the freedom to say, you know, they want everything, you know, unicorns and bells and whistles and all of it. But at least it gives you something to aim for. So, you know, you start by asking those personas, those people that are going to consume it, what they want. You use that to inform where you go with your minimum viable whatever. You then maybe come at it from the other end and look at your inputs and say, you know, fine, well, what data actually do I have available? You know, what can I get from my source systems, and what do I need to do to it? Is it a source system that's, you know, so remote and it sits on some third-party database system that no one's ever heard of, and we need to use an ADBC driver or something really painful to interact with it? You know, and that can maybe inform some of your pragmatism. Because if, you know, 90% of your valuable data is locked up in a source system that's really hard to get to, then, yeah, that might dictate what you have to build. or you know, all of your valuable data is in a source system that's really easy, but yeah, you know, there's just that 10% that's in a source system that's difficult to get to. Again, it informs what you're going to do. So yeah, that's kind of like input versus output. If we then think about the glue in the middle, the process, then what I tend to do is use a technical capability map that's, you know, it's got everything on it from things that you alluded to earlier around governance and security, but then it's got, you know, like a menu of what your platform is going to deliver. Things in there like, okay, is it going to be batch process data, or is it going to be more real-time streaming data? Are you going to want to create a data model out of it? Do you need a semantic layer? You know, what else is going to go into this platform? Do you need that virtualization layer? Do you need event-driven processing? You know, is it a Lambda or a Kappa architecture that you're aiming for? You know, all of those technical capabilities that could be put into the middle will then also kind of inform what you're going to do. So yeah, kind of maybe three ways to go about it, that input, process, and output, to try and touch on a few of them to inform what you do.
How are you finding those conversations where you are stressing the pragmatism, right? Like, because historically we have had requirements, requests, right? Like, and then that goes to the data team, you know, the data engineering team or whatever. And then they go to the producers and they try and communicate. And, you know, it's kind of that office space thing of, you know, I take the freaking requests from the engineers and I take them from the customers to the engineers. I'm a people person, right? Like, how do we kind of get ourselves out of being in that middle and getting them to directly communicate, and then kind of working with both sides to talk about, okay, well, you want X, you know, you talk about that 90-10. Is that 10% of the data the most valuable? Or can you say, hey, it's going to take us a month and, you know, 100 person hours to, or, you know, 1,000 person hours or whatever, to get to that 90%, that extra 10% is going to take another 5 months. So, you know, are you going to pay for that extra 5 months? Do you want to wait that 5 months? Or is that data really that valuable to you? And if it is, okay, like, let's talk about that. But if it's not, you know, being able to just not say, here's your list of what things that you want, like, how have you kind of moved forward into that negotiation instead of ask setting, or that requirements document instead of like the actual conversation of let's become practical, let's get pragmatic.
Yeah, I mean, business value, you know, is always a good sort of North Star on some of this stuff. Yeah, what is going to give us the most value from this data? You know, it is always definitely a good test. You know, to your point earlier around sensitive data, we could easily deliver, you know, a whole bunch of stuff in there and get value from it. But yeah, somebody says, oh, it would be nice if we had the sensitive data in there as well. But of course, you know that that's going to take a massive load of governance and security and anonymization of records, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so you have to say to somebody that sensitive data, you might find it useful in your reports. You might need it to go and tell so-and-so to stop doing something to improve performance or whatever. But yeah, if that's the only requirement, then yeah, that it's not worth the technical effort in delivering it. And I think you end up being just a translator between the people with the demand or the ask or the business requirement, and you know, the translator to then the technical effort it takes to deliver it. You know, I sit between the person that wants the output and maybe the scrum master that's got to do the refinement on his backlog and say, okay, well, we've got a whole bunch of stuff, you know, we've got a 2-week sprint. Are we going to be able to deliver that value for this person that's asking for it? And then, you know, if all else fails, we just come back to, well, who's going to shout the loudest? Who's the most senior? Who's got the most budget within the organization to deliver it? you know, if we're building something on a cloud platform that's pay-as-you-go, who's going to pay for it? that's always a good indicator as well. That's, you know, sensitive data handling. It could require a massive load of technical work and engineering, and it could mean that the running cost of your platform, you know, triples or whatever. So suddenly you say, well, fine, we can do this, but your running cost is going to triple. Do you still want it? You know, you can ask lots of probing questions like that to really sort of tease out, do you really want this? Do you really need this?
So one thing that some people have talked about, and I think it tends to be when there's less complicated of data products, right? Especially when it's the single table or a view instead of a full data set and things like that. And, you know, we can get into whether that's really data mesh or not. I don't really care at the end of the day. I'm like, the whole point of what I'm trying to do with all of this stuff with data mesh and the community and all that is get to a place where people can understand how to get good value out of their data, and that it's not so hard, and that we're not banging our head against the wall. But a lot of people have talked about getting themselves entirely, you know, if you're that translator, that more and more you're getting yourself more and more out of the conversation. And so it becomes a negotiation between the producer and the consumer. Like, are you finding that, you know, as you go along, you still have to be in those conversations? Or are you finding that, you know, more and more that those conversations are happening where you're kind of stepping in to give some information, but not saying what this person means is and what this person means, you know, that translator versus that kind of attaché of like, hey, let me add some additional color, versus you two are talking completely different languages. Are you finding that that's actually the case, or are you finding that that's the hopeful case and it's not really the case in most instances, or what are you actually seeing from your experiences?
It feels like kind of all of the above, actually. I think it comes down to, in some cases, the culture within the business. You know, are they really data driven? It comes down to some of the technical ability, the skill sets, or you know, the influence that the C-level people in the industry have. You know, do they appreciate what it means to get that insight from it? It comes down to the maturity of the platform that you've delivered. You know, if there's a platform that's very mature, which means that there's low friction to actually onboarding a new data set, it's very easy, you know, then I'm not required, because, you know, the hard work has been done to actually deliver that product as a service, as a platform. So it means, you know, we've done that upfront engineering work, and it means that there's less friction. If, yeah, it's more of a brownfield type solution where onboarding a new data set from maybe a third party like SAP or something, not to be too critical, of course, but, you know, getting a new data set via SAP BW or something like that can be a huge effort and require a lot of people involved and a lot of friction. And, you know, you then do need to be that translator in the room sometimes. So I feel like I'm giving you a long answer of it depends, but I guess hopefully through some of that narrative, we can figure out, yeah, what that actually depends on. And I think it's a mixture. It's all very subjective.
But are you seeing, like, it's kind of the, is there a light at the end of the tunnel question of, are you seeing that as you're working with clients, that as they move forward with their own data mesh maturity, that you are becoming less and less that translator? Or is it really, really situationally dependent, not just on, like, on the client itself? Each client is completely different, and so you're having to play that translator role even in, you know, I mean, I don't think you're at year three or year four of delivering data mesh to anybody, but are you seeing that it becomes less and less necessary, and that those conversations start from that negotiation point and that there is less of a need for translator? Or is it very, very situationally dependent on, like you said, like what is the actual situation with the production side and with the consumption side of, do you need something very complicated on the consumption side? Or if the production side is very, very complicated, no matter what, even if they're the most advanced client you've got, there still needs to be a significant amount of translation to be like, this is incredibly difficult. Let's get to where we can get to some value sooner, but that this is going to be a long, long-term process.
I'm gonna be optimistic. I'm gonna say that yes, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. An example recently, we had a bunch of source systems. We looked at the underlying database technologies for them. We found that the majority of the source systems were actually sat on SQL Server instances. So, fine, you do the upfront engineering work that says, well, this is the majority of the tech I've got to work with. Let's create an ingestion pattern and handling for that type of source system, SQL Server. And then, of course, it means that you've got all of that work and it's done. And then, as we hopefully move towards that light in the tunnel, that somebody comes along in 6 months' time and says, hey, I've got a new source system here. They say, fine, what's it running on? They say SQL Server. They say, no problem. We've got that in our marketplace already. And, if we're following some of that data mesh theory of reducing the requirement on that hyper-specialized skill, that may be that person or something that we need to create to get data out of that SQL Server database in this case, then, that's done. It becomes easier. I think there is light at the end of the tunnel as the platform evolves and as the platform matures and, the software and the technology that we use matures as well. I think we do end up getting there. It does become easier, or at least I hope so.
I think Henrik Gothberg again had talked about, and I'm going to have a couple of episodes on this coming up, I think, on chasing reusability, right? Because the more that you can say, okay, look, 80-20 principle, Pareto principle, like 80% of the time this is going to be applicable, like just find those and automate as many of those as possible so that you don't have friction. And so that if somebody wants to bring on a new data set and it's not complicated or complex, they can do that in, sometimes a couple of days, right? Where you go, okay, we're going to bring on a new data set. Okay, we've got kind of an idea. We've got a consumer for it. Hey, boom, we're going to do that. And we can measure people using it because a lot of data isn't that complicated. It's just, we don't have the CI/CD and the everything there. And then you can spend your time on the things that are trickier, right? But we just haven't had in data, what I find when I talk to people historically, we just haven't had that like repeatability and reusability is not something that people have focused on enough. And it's crazy to me, like coming at it from kind of more the software development side of the world of that we just haven't really thought of how to do that. But it's good that data mesh is spurring a lot of those conversations, but whether you're doing data mesh or not, you should be doing that type of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, we use the analogy of crawling, walking, and running, and what does that look like for each part of what we're trying to do? And, for the data engineer type persona, then absolutely I see that, you crawl when you start writing some code, you create some assets and things and a few reusable functions or whatever that you've got. And, you then start to run and you get those reusable libraries, those templates, you get some metadata that starts driving what you're doing. And you run and then you get a full configuration driven template that's very sort of cookie cutter, stamp it out and you're good to go. So I see that evolution happening, and absolutely it's something that in data, I agree, we've had an absence of And yeah, I think it's good that the data mesh principles that we've got are making us think about that.
Yeah, I think the concept of data as a product is so much broader than data mesh in general. And that's originally the concept was for the podcast was going to be data as a product in general, and then data mesh was going to be maybe one of the episodes a week, and just kind of decided not to go down that because there just wasn't as much kind of practitioner advice within the data mesh content I was seeing. But so one question that kind of dovetails nicely off what we've been talking about, but might also be a difficult question to kind of put you on the spot on, but there's a lot of people who are trying to figure out what is a data product, and every company is kind of looking at this differently. And you know, is that a table or a view, or is that a full data set? Is that, you know, what is actually necessary here? And I think it's fine to have, even if you've got like a lot of ones where data sets, you know, complex data sets are your data products. If you've got one where the only need is a table or a view, then fine, that's a data product, right? But like, what do you see as when you think about, well, I guess two long questions that, you know, you can expound upon for quite a bit, but like, what do you think of that, of looking at that crawl, walk, run for what needs to be for each part, like that minimum viable for a data product? And then maybe you can wrap in at after that as well, how you start to think about that on the data platform side. Like, what are the crawl things so that you can start to move? You can get moving forward. You can get towards value. It doesn't have to be perfect. You can head towards your North Star. But like, when you think about it on a data product level and a data platform level, let's start with the data product. But like, what are the crawl, walk, run of what you need to have in place? We kind of talked about that a little bit, but would love to kind of hear your definition of a data product and how you kind of get towards that evolution, iterate.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And yeah, it can be a difficult one to answer. And I've seen my customers answer it and then seen, of course, what they've done and what they think about as a data product. But I'm gonna take a tangent and say maybe the way I would answer it of what is a data product, I would say any data that you need to answer a question that you have. So yeah, if the question is, you know, what was my sales last month, or what was my total, what was my profit, you know, you've got a set of questions like that, and you want to get the answers for them. I would say that anything that we can create that answers those questions for that person with that need, you know, that need to answer them, for me, that becomes almost a data product, you know, in its simplest form. It's just the ability of something to answer some questions that you have. Now, it could be that, you know, you have a data product that, of course, can answer 100 different questions. But, you know, you've got to start, I think, with at least one question. And, you know, you start with one question, and always, I think, is the case that once somebody has answered one question with some data, it always ends up spawning 10 more questions. And, you know, and hopefully that's in a data-driven environment, that would be expected. But, yeah, I would say, to try and be maybe hopefully not overly simplistic about it, but yeah, a data product is it's that ability to answer a question or many questions. And yeah, maybe we try and quantify it and say, okay, you've got 10 questions, go and get the bits of data that you need to answer those 10 questions, and then we can say to you, okay, fine, we can call that your data product. But absolutely, answering those 10 questions could come from a single table. You know, I think that's fine. I don't really care, you know, how those questions are answered, what the underlying tech or what even it looks like. But if you're satisfied with the answers you get, then you know, fine. Let's go with that.
What would take it from data to a data product, right? Like, especially in a data mesh concept, because we talked about that single data run. That's not a data product, right? At least not in my mind. That's not at all, right? So that can answer the questions. If somebody asked it today, I can go and tell you this is what our sales were yesterday, but they come back to it the next day. And, you know, then do I have to do that same data run? And it's a manual run and things like that. Like, what takes it from data to the actual product concept, especially inside Data Mesh, right? Like, what does it have to have? Certain CI/CD concepts? Does it have to have certain reusability concepts? Does it have to have, you know, observability and SLAs and all that? Or what takes it from being kind of that initial stage of V0.1 to a V1.0 to a V2.0, right? And that's kind of maybe the crawl, the walk, the run.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, your data becomes your information, your knowledge, your power, whatever, and yeah, that's fine. But it's about that scalability of that environment, that consistency that you bring, the platform and all of its reusability that you bring, yeah, the standard set of interfaces that you've got within your mesh, the ability to publish a data set to a marketplace that exists on that mesh. That means that because you've answered your questions, you know, it means that others might have similar questions and they can go to that marketplace. They can find that data set that you've onboarded and they can also use it. You know, so it's not just about onboarding it because you had that singular requirement. It's about making that data available for everybody in that mesh ecosystem, which I think is the difference there. You know, it's a product that's been publicized for everybody to use. It just happens to be that, say, you were the first person that had the question that needed answering. So I think that's probably the distinction I would make.
So, like, if I'm getting kind of technical on it, I mean, like, does it need a presumably it needs to have metadata about what is the data so that it can be understandable. I mean, is it just kind of the you know, JMAC has kind of 8 principles about being discoverable and understandable and all that stuff. Is it just that, or is there like additional things that you think that make it so that where again, the crawl, and then like, how do you evolve it? I know it's a difficult question because it's such a broad question, but it also can feel extremely overly specific question. But like, what I'm finding is in my conversations with people, especially, you know, not on the podcast, almost every company is having extreme difficulty in defining what is a data product and what isn't a data product. So like, do you have even just some advice on people for people that are trying to share that with, not with their consumers, but with their producers, like, so they can understand what they owe when, you know, what is your homework? what are your check boxes that you need to meet before you can say that this is data mesh ready, even at that crawl phase?
Yeah, I think the discoverable, the reliable, the consistent, all of those things I think are absolutely true. But I think what we should also kind of add into the equation there is you know, a time element to it. Is this data actually valuable? You know, it was valuable at the point I needed it, but is it then valuable? In the long term? Is that data going to be used forever? You know, just because you answered that one question, is that one question now going to become a metric on the CEO's dashboard that he receives on his phone every Monday morning or whatever? You know, so there's a time element to that. And I think, you've got your data that's consistent, discoverable. It's got all of the platform goodness around it, which meant that, you know, you could get it and you could onboard it. But yeah, I think if you do that, and it then becomes about, yes, it's a data product if you've demonstrated value from that data, you've demonstrated some revenue that's now been generated because of that insight that you've gained. I think it almost feels like maybe, you know, to use like a fake news analogy or something, that if you've onboarded a data set that isn't valuable, it doesn't get used by everybody, then I'd probably take the stance of, well, you know, that's not a good product. That's not a data product. That's just data noise, maybe. Let's call it that. You know, it's data noise within the mesh that isn't helping anybody. So the value in time is perhaps how I would kind of test that definition.
And kind of same question of what I'm trying to get towards is there is, well, I guess it's that technical purity question, right? Of what can we get out that's that V0.1? And so when we think about that on the platform side, like what do you think is necessary to have on the platform side? Is it it is chicken and egg. So you can't say to have a data platform, you need to have the templates on how to get out data until you start to work with what your initial data products are. So, but like, if we're talking about that V0.1, that kind of proof of value, not just the proof of concept of getting a single data product out, but like proof of value of a mesh, like, what do you think are the things that people have to put in there, and what are the things that they can kind of jury rig up front and that they just have to set themselves to iterate to improve over time?
Yeah, it's hard. I feel like another analogy is maybe required, like a car or something, but I sometimes think about, I've spoken about a data mesh as like a car, and the data products are the wheels. You know, a car works best with four wheels, you know, so you've got that as a minimum, maybe. Maybe you have to have four data products. And then, you know, if we think about the chassis of the car, the engine, the steering wheel, the doors, whatever, you know, what does that mean to us in terms of that technical platform? And you know, we have to have resources that we can easily deploy. We have to have ingestion processes to get the data in, of course. We have to have means of discovering the data and getting the output from it. We have to have a query plane. We have to have that ability for those users, the consumers, to be able to get to that data. And I think there is... If you really want to scale and you do want to iterate, it does feel like that entry level data mesh environment, that entry level data mesh architecture, you know, that entry level is really high. It's a really high bar to try and hit, even as a minimum viable solution. So there's obviously a whole bunch of stuff in there, and I think about the Azure tech a lot, and my customers, you know, they want the networking and the infrastructure. They don't want anything to be using public endpoints. So, you know, that ends up becoming a minimum viable requirement. They have to have a security model. They have to have all of the log telemetry for the operational reporting. You know, so suddenly, depending on the customer you work with and greenfield versus brownfield, the platform suddenly becomes a massive thing. And you know, maybe we're circling a little bit on that, but it's, yeah, there really is so much in there to make a minimum viable data mesh that, as I said earlier, it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of why Jamak and I've talked about, if you're actually doing like what Jamak has talked about with data mesh, like if you're a 1,000-person company, almost 100% of the time, it's too high of a cost to really go down this road. But you can get value where you don't, like where if you're constantly actually asking and thinking about that negotiation aspect of what don't we need to do, right? Like, what isn't the value add right now? Set ourselves up so we can add it when we need it, but like, where can we get to our return on investment, not just our return, right? Like a 100-person company implementing a data mesh would presumably have a very high return on that data mesh, but the cost is going to be 50x what the return is. So yes, you're going to get more value out of your data, but like your actual cost of it, it's not worth it versus, you know, for a much larger company, you do have to think about that. But then your required investment with size and complexity and kind of situation increases constantly. So yeah, I think it's a difficult question to ask. And that's, you know, I said I'm putting you on the spot a bit on it because it just kind of came to mind.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, to try and offer a different perspective as well, you know, if we think about a brownfield type environment, you know, a customer has got, say, siloed teams operating, they've got, you know, these disparate data products maybe that are out there. And what you do is you do a gap analysis. You find that actually for 10 of the data products, they're using the same data source. And you say to them, well, actually, instead of duplicating that data for your isolated data products, let's bring them together into a mesh, and let's, you know, you share that data from the one domain that is going to own it. And you know that this is good. And you think about that, but actually, even trying to do that as well, I think becomes hard because it means that what those other data products have to stop consuming that data source, and then get it from this new central place—not central, but you know—get it from the right data domain. And I think even that sometimes becomes a refactoring exercise that somebody will ultimately ask the question and say, well, "Okay, fine. I've done this. I'm now adopting this domain orientated principle of getting the data that I need. What was the value in me doing that?" And you know, the only real thing you can quantify, other than all of the development effort and engineering effort in getting there, is say, well, actually, now your running costs are slightly reduced because you're not duplicating this data set. You know, and the source system, its workload is now easier. You're not overburdening that source system because you get the data once for the domain that becomes the owner of it. It feels like, yeah, it's the same answer, but maybe a slightly different scenario of a brownfield, and yeah, the same answer of it's high and it's hard.
Yeah, that's interesting. That the when the output to a consumer really hasn't changed, you know, they're like, why do I care? And it's like, well, if you only care about this one single point of what you were doing, maybe you don't, but in the greater scheme, you're going to have better access to better data with more understandability, with more reliability and quality and, you know, all this stuff. But, you know, if they are just saying, well, what have you done for me lately constantly, then that's that can be a challenge. I think that's kind of the same thing on the producer side of trying to get people bought in that they need to produce. It's like, well, if we all do this, it's like, yeah, but you're asking me to do this right now. I don't care what happens if we all do this. I care that you're asking me to do this right now. And so, yeah, I think it's a difficult question to answer, and kind of there isn't, it all is, it depends.
Yeah, it's business value add versus technical efforts, I think, to get there is obviously that Venn diagram almost of, you know, and where's the overlap, and yeah, what do we actually need to do? What's the roadmap?
Yeah, measuring the actual value of the data is incredibly difficult. And so trying to have that return on investment conversation of like, what is our return? When, you know, internal rate of return, you know, how quickly do we get to that? And what's the, you know, value that this actually adds, and what are we actually going to spend investing to get there? It's fun finance conversations, which technical people typically do not like to have, as somebody who is the finance person embedded in a technical organization.
Yeah. Yeah, so often it becomes a reactive thing, doesn't it? We're reacting to something that means we're trying to predict something from happening. Machine maintenance or something like that. We're trying to predict it going wrong, so we try and stop it.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, Paul, this has been really, really great. So, you know, is there anything that you kind of want to let people know about, or is there any like summation of the conversation? I mean, typically the answer is no, it's impossible to just put a button on an hour long conversation, but is there anything that you think that you'd kind of give as kind of a summation wrapping up point to people to really think about, like kind of your main philosophy, or if not, you know, we can kind of just jump into where people can find you and get in touch with you. But
I think I would say I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't claim that there's a perfect solution out there yet. I think I would just say, you know, to keep a growth mindset of let's figure it out together. We've got a very rich we've got a very rich data community that we can all call upon and knowledge share and things. And that's, I guess, what I'm doing via my blog. And I do put in a lot of my blog posts that I'm writing this blog post to get my own thoughts in order, because these things are hard, and I don't mind going first, being wrong, and, you know, failing fast together with our learning approach to it as well. So I think that's maybe how I would summarize the topic at the moment of let's figure it out together, and we will make mistakes along the way.
Yeah, that's why the data mesh community is literally called data mesh learning. Like, that's the whole point. It's that we're not at a thing where it's like data mesh knowledge sharing. It's certain people have all the answers. Nobody's got all the answers, and we're figuring it out. You know, Jmack said something on an interview recently that we're way early, even for what are the patterns, not even what are best practice patterns or what are typical patterns or what are the, we're still very, very early. So getting people to kind of share that stuff is very, very valuable. So, speaking of your blog, I'll drop that in the show notes, as well as a link to where do you want people kind of getting in touch with you, and what do you want people kind of following up with you about? You know, is that LinkedIn or Twitter, or, you know, your blog, or what do you kind of want people reaching out about?
I guess, yeah, I don't mind whatever they're comfortable. I use the handle of Mr. Paul Andrew, and you know, I use that for my blog, Twitter, LinkedIn, GitHub, whatever, you know. I use Mr. Paul Andrew for everything across the board. So yeah, reach out to me. I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'd love to hear your thoughts on my recent data mesh blogs as well.
Like I said, I'll drop a link to that in the show notes as well. So, but Paul, this has been really, really great. And I really thank you for taking the time, and thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Paul Andrew, a technical architect at Avanade and a Microsoft Data Platform MVP. As per usual, you can find Paul's contact information as well as a link to his blog posts about data mesh in the show notes. Thank you. Thanks everyone for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full time to help out the data mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering, and or an easy to scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with data mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.